In the spring, in addition to a career panel in the fall, admissions law and technology. If you are a law student interested in joining our staff, please feel free to speak to me or any of the other journal representatives during the lunch break. Also, if you're interested in learning about our print publication, you may visit the table outside and browse through our latest issues or subscribe. Today we have with us two panels of leading members and policymakers in the telecommunications industry. Later this afternoon, we will be exploring the regulation of the telecommunications industry with a focus on the Telecommunications Act of 1996. But first, this morning's panel, entitled Building the On-Ramps to the Information Superhighway, will examine the ongoing competition among advanced telecommunications providers and related issues. Moderating our panel this morning is Jonathan Zittrain. Mr. Zittrain is Executive Director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School, and lecturer on law, teaching Internet and Society, the Microsoft case, and the legal and technical architectures of cyberspace. He has worked for the U.S. Department of State and the U.S. Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. He also holds a Bachelor of Science degree in Cognitive Science and Artificial Intelligence from Yale, and a JD and MPA from Harvard Law School and the Kennedy School. Thank you again for joining us, and I hope you enjoy today's event. Jonathan?
Good morning. Forgive me for upending your speech while getting our wireless section of today's thing going. And of course, we have wireless. We also, in order to be entirely fair, I believe we have some form of broadband going on. There's actually a video camera right there. And if you care to read your paper, I actually checked. Those watching on the other end can read your paper along with you. If you just hold a little bit more to the right with the camera. And those of you in the audience who are sympathetic to the broadcasting concerns may actually be interested in seeing how we've taken care of the last 10 feet over on the other room, just mirror to this one, is an exact replica of what's going on here, except it's on video screens. So that's no commercials, it's just pay-per-view. So you can go over there, if for some reason the seats aren't comfortable, sort of salt among yourselves and make comments with the video replication of what's going on in here. So good morning to all of you. Good morning to all of you. I thought it might be nice just to start by getting introductions. And by way of introductions, just hearing from each of you who you are, who you represent. If you only represent one company, which can include companies that your company has swallowed, if you're only representing one company, what rough industrial areas, what areas of interest your company touches upon, please limit yourself to 5 to 10 minutes for that. I'd also like to know what your greatest dream and your worst nightmare over the next 5 to 10 years. I know 10 years is a millennium in internet time. The next 5 to 10 years, what's your greatest dream and your greatest nightmare for what might happen? I actually recall the, I'm sure, apocryphal story of people just coming into Harvard Law School, and they are told by the dean in their first assembly, look to your left, look to your right. Within 3 years, only one of you will remain. And I wonder if that isn't true for this panel, but I'm interested to find out if that plays out in the greatest dream and the greatest nightmare. That holds for the FCC, too. But, anyway, let's start with Mr. Petrillo.
Thank you. I'm John Petrillo. I head up the corporate strategy and business development effort at AT&T and work for Mike Armstrong. With regards to the businesses that we've enhanced by coming together, obviously, we have cable interests, wireless interests, long distance interests, and local service interests for both business markets and consumer markets, which, by the way, are different, and our relationship with the British Telecom and international interests. So we span the spectrum. And my group works with Sean and the senior leaders to figure out where to go and invest to build this capability. I guess to make it quick, my hope is that we're going to realize the advance of the technologies and policymaking that will unleash, I think, the next generation of what our society can do as an information economy around the world. I see a lot of benefit for the peoples around the world for that, not only American citizens. And so I think we have the opportunity to lead a great enhancement to the world society if we do it right. My fear is that as between business leaders, policymakers at the government level, and the academics, we won't think properly, lead it properly, we might have told.
Now you've drawn blood, you've already blamed the academics.
I'm Charles Brewer. I'm from Mindspring, which I started as a major telecom startup with 8 modems. Atlanta. 5 years ago this summer, and we're an ISP focused on individual customers and small businesses. We've grown from being local to regional to national, and I believe we're now the fourth largest ISP with about 1.1 million customers. And I have no legal sort of credentials whatsoever, which made it a must for me to accept this invitation. And we have been very active in the debate around concerning open access to the cable broadband infrastructure. We're a founding member of the Open Net Coalition, and it's something I personally have put a lot of effort and a lot of my time into recently. I guess the way I'd like to see this whole telecom world work out is that when somebody calls and wants to get connected to the core telecom service in the future, which is going to be their broadband internet connection, there are a variety of choices that they have. And first of all, they have a variety of choices that can deliver this service. And say they wisely choose Mindspring, and they call Mindspring and say, "Where do you live?" And they say, 123 Main Street. And we say, "Great, we have a dial-up modem connection available there. We have DSL connection available there. We also have cable modem connection available there. Here are the prices, and which one would you like to choose?" And I think that general sort of structure would preserve a lot of the great things about the internet that we have today, because I think it really is the openness and therefore the competition and the innovation that go with that that really driven the success of the internet. It's why it's as great a thing as it is. And I guess the nightmare scenario is maybe it's best sums up in the words interactive TV, where it's sort of a master plan. You're limited in your choices of who your service provider is to the very limited number of companies that actually own a wire coming to your house, and that is not going to be a big number and does not lend itself to the sort of competitive, innovative world that I think would be best for everybody.
Now, that's the nightmare for the consumer. What's the nightmare for Mindspring? I mean, I'm sure whatever the consumer's nightmare is also Mindspring's, but I mean, you're out of business. Is that the worst case?
Well, there are two wires that are viable nowadays. Nobody really knows yet which one will be the better answer in the most places, but we can, if the cable infrastructure by some horrible quirk of fate were to remain closed to us, we can certainly try to make our business based on the other wire, or if need be, we could try to evolve the business to something that didn't depend on that last mile connectivity to homes quite so exclusively.
Gotcha.
I'm Jim Cassidy. I'm senior advisor to Commissioner Ness at the FCC. I've served with her throughout the 5 years she's been at the commission, and worked with her on pretty much all the issues, but more in the area of telephony than wireless and international and mass media. There's been more to do there. I think we all probably have the same vision. You know, lots of competition and minimal regulation. That's Congress gets to pick the vision, and that's the vision they've picked.
Is the vision, I mean, I'm just asking as the academic.
Yeah.
The corporate vision is lots of competition. That's what you want?
Well, that's, I'll leave it to them to say whether that's what they all really
I mean, Bill Gates. Does Bill Gates want lots of competition?
You will have to ask him.
Do I really need to ask him? I mean, I would think that the dream of a corporation, which I take to be a rational, self-maximizing company, would be a field in which there's no competition, in which they've got the lock, right?
Maybe the answer is, I think what we might all be able to agree on is an environment in which a variety of companies have an unfettered opportunity to compete on the merits.
Yeah, freedom to throttle everyone else.
Well, or freedom to excel and to thrive, and others may suffer if they can't excel the way you do. I mean, that's not a comment on Microsoft, but companies, you know, there are rewards for doing better than your competitors. That's part of it. So I can speak only for one commissioner, but I think it's probably generally the case that. I mean, I just want to be careful not to ascribe to the commission sentiments that haven't been voted on by the commission. But let me say, I think the commission as a whole is pretty wedded to the vision of this act, which is we're not picking winners and losers.
Right.
We are trying to just create an environment that follows the law and opens the doors for lots of folks. And our vision is not just one in which there will be two entities providing, it would be an improvement for most of us to have two entities offering us a broadband service, a cable company and a telephone company, but we hope to get further than that. We hope that a telephone wire right now can be a CLEC using it and not the ILEC, or a competitive local exchange carrier, not the incumbent local exchange carrier.
Oh, well done, we got through our first acronym.
Yeah, sorry, I'm trying to avoid being the one to use the next set of acronyms. So, The dream would be that we keep going down the road that we think we're going down, that where competition is coming and consumers are getting more choices and prices are going down and the capabilities are increasing. When you said nightmare, I thought it was a personal nightmare. My personal nightmare, which I just had as I sat here, was that I'm back in first year of law school and I'm a test next tomorrow and I don't have that anymore. I didn't know I was signed up for the course, but
I hate that one.
What would the commission's nightmare be? Probably that, again, maybe just for my boss, that the agency doesn't have the resources or the backing to continue to do the job it's doing. Generally, we're pretty proud of what's happened. A lot of the many good things that have been happening in the market are things that come from seeds that were planted a long time ago. You just have to tend that garden, let those seedlings sprout and bear fruit.
It's great because it shows there might be a correlation between keeping up funding and staff for the FCC and minimal regulation, and actually making sure you fund the government is helping ensure minimal regulation.
No, helping the commission, let me say, if the commission does its job and as the market gets more competitive, I think there a lot of the regulatory functions will atrophy and be eliminated. There are other functions that will that come into play only because it's a competitive market. One of the major problems we have in the long-distance market is the problem of slamming, where your long-distance companies changed against your will. That was a problem you didn't have in the old days when you only had one long-distance company. So. The regulation will be changing, but my goal wasn't to argue that we ought to maintain an FCC of a certain size or a certain budget, but let's continue the work and not, I mean, we're trying to make the competition happen, and then deregulation can accompany that as opposed to making competition rather than deregulation the goal.
Right.
Good morning. My name is Edward Young. I'm the Senior Vice President and Deputy General Counsel of Bell Atlantic. I'm happy to be here. When I was last year, so the building wasn't here, so I don't have the nightmare with not having studied for the test. Probably standing in the middle of my favorite football field. You know, my job at Bell Atlantic is to get rid of regulation that stands in the way of are pursuing our business opportunities both at the federal and state level. And if I had to think about my my best dream, it would be that there would be no regulation, that when we get up in the morning to decide what we're going to offer, it's unfettered by regulatory concerns about open networks, non-discrimination. And that doesn't mean that it suggests that we want to be able to discriminate about closed networks, but that the people that we're competing with don't have those restrictions, and as a result, they're free to offer their services on the most economically efficient basis. We don't have those freedoms. We're sort of caught by the history of the regulation of telecommunications, starting off Bell Minix, starting off as a local tele exchange company regulated. I guess the other part of the dream that I have is you heard about the species where the parents eat their young. Well, it has been a reverse dream of having an investment of AT&T and want to turn around and eat them. But the fact of the matter is we want to be free to compete in an environment where we don't have any discrimination.
And your markets, the markets you represent include?
Well, we're in the cellular area. That's probably our highest growth area. We provide local exchange service. We are not in the long distance business. That's a result of first the divestiture decree administered by Judge Green, and then in 1996, the Telecommunications Act prescribed the way in which we could offer long distance service. Clearly, Congress intended by now that we would be in the long distance business. There's not a single former Bell operating company that's in the long distance business. The way we know the Congress intended that we would be in right now is there certain provisions that phased out this year on the assumption that we would be in.
And yet, oddly, Congress didn't just say, you're in.
Well, it's interesting. During the debate for the shaping of the bill, one proposal was, let's pick a date certain, like February 1999. And on that date, you'll be in long distance. And we said, 3 years? Are you kidding? We'll be in before then. But ironically, that date is coming on, and we're still not in the long distance business.
And you're saying this is a strategic blunder on your part, overestimating just how...
Maybe we underestimated the deal of others who were responsible for opening the markets.
Gotcha. Great. Well, so let me start by asking you, Charles. You're in the dial-up ISP business, and that means that if I'm sitting with a computer and I want to get onto the internet, and all I've got is a telephone, and at that, I've only got POTS, right? Plain old telephone service. I can hook my modem up to the phone, and if one of the disks falling from the sky out of helicopters containing dial-up ISP software on it happens to be yours, I might stick it into my hard drive or my computer, install it, and then I'm on the internet. Now, what we're talking about in some of these other areas is high-speed broadband access that might be coming thanks to the phone company developing some particular way of using those phone lines so they're no longer POTS. They've got high-speed access inherently, which means nobody has to dial up anymore, or these so-called cable modems, cable broadband, through which, again, you don't have to dial up anymore. So I guess, just to try to understand the strategic position you're in right now, are you somewhat like the guy that has Blockbuster Video, and you've got a great business, people come in, they're paying $3 for several days rental of a video, they take it home, and he knows that in 5 years, at some point, they're going to figure out how to do video jukebox over your TV, at which point he's probably out of business unless somehow he gets into the pay-per-view business. Is that a fair characterization of your situation?
Well, there's no question that the internet access we're all going to use in the future is not going to be dialing up. I mean, it's going to need a core service to it. It's going to subsume everything else in telecom. It'll be your voice. It'll be most of your video. There'll be lots of applications we can't even think of today. And once in our homes, we are connected in that always-on, higher-speed fashion, we won't be dialing up. So, the crux of your question is back to the central debate here, is that infrastructure that allows these higher-speed connections open to competitive service providers or not. And by the law of the land on the phone side, it is. I think, actually, in reality, it's turning out that it is also, because it seems that the regional bell operating companies of the world have become very enthusiastic about DSL. They said, we must keep this data service on our network, and we're going to build out the network. We're going to drastically accelerate their investment in upgrading the plant to let DSL work. you know what? We don't care that much whether it's HelloAtlantic.net or Mindspring.com. As long as the traffic's right in our network, we're pretty happy. So on the DSL side, I think our ability to get access and to continue to provide service to our customers is pretty clear. On the cable side, of course, it's currently closed to us, except by some very minor exceptions, and that's sort of the battle we're fighting right now.
Now, I understand that the thing's going well, say, with HelloAtlantic. From the consumer's point of view, what that means is if I get DSL, I'll have some, by choosing my provider, I'm choosing whose homepage I'll see first when I first boot my browser. Will it be Mindspring.com, and it says, welcome to Mindspring, did you know you're our customer? Or it might be HelloAtlantic, welcome to HelloAtlantic, did you know you're our customer? Is there anything else to it as far as the consumer's concerned?
Yes. In fact, that's a very offensively sort of minimalistic description of our job.
I did not mean to offensively minimalize.
Actually, the cable industry sort of tries to make it sound like that the last mile connection is the whole thing. If you look at what customers appear to care about in our market, there are maybe really three primary basics. And one is making it easy. And AOL, they probably do that better than anybody. And it's hugely important. And so the user interface, the easy startup experience, providing an easy way to find and use applications that are going to be important to you is critical. And the second thing is the network itself, which it consists of both the last mile piece and also the wide area connectivity. And in fact, it's crucial to be able to have choice of providers that provide different sort of wide area connections to the backbone and transport beyond the last mile. If you only have one choice of who your ISP is, and they have, for example, don't support virtual private network kind of functions or don't support the kind of quality of service that you need to do voice applications over the net, you know, if you have a choice, you have a lot. So the network is and then the third is support. And this has been hugely more important in the ISP business than in any other telecom business before, because even if we're perfect, you know, your computer's not, your modem's not, the internet's not, your user skills may not be. And when any of those things go wrong, you can't tell what it is. Just, hey, you know, my internet's broken, I better call my ISP. So those three things are all critically important. Surely for us, our strongest differentiating capability has been on support. It has nothing to do with the last mile connection whatsoever. And if you think about this telecom world of the future with a local area network in the home, and all these different devices, phone-like devices to do voice over the net, video devices, one-way, two-way, you know, these incredible ones you probably can't even think of yet, and all of these things sharing your internet connection, you know, it's going to be hard. And it's going to take a lot of support. And if you are reliant upon a single company, or maybe two, you need neither one of which you necessarily have a real strong record in providing that sort of support, that's going to really hamper people's ability to use the network. So all those things are critically important.
So John, I was in danger of offensively minimalizing what was called on it, and it sounded as if then I was accused, or not accused, but said these are the arguments you hear from the cable interests. Now, I suppose among your bundle of interests includes cable. So Charles has just put it to the cable people to say, look, you've got a closed network right now. Why shouldn't we get in? The way we could get in is by, it'd be our customer service people instead of your customer service people. It'd be our installation disk instead of your installation disk. And then there was that second feature, he said, that seemed to suggest they'd be in at the packet level. Somehow there'd just be a conduit that is cable, and it might be his packet sharing space with your packets, routing out to different customers along the way. How does that vision sound to you?
I think George has done a great job of describing his business, and it's a good one.
This is Charles, right?
Charles.
It's where people often call me George.
Yeah.
It happens all the time.
It's having intellectually developed people to do that, I suppose. Anyway, fiber issues. I clearly make the same assertions because it's part of his business strategy, and he's obviously pursuing the interests of a shareholder in his business. So I think I described his comments as appropriate and accurate for what he says.
Are they wrong?
They're wrong in terms of how you define the problem. We got to first parse it up. And the first way I parse it up is, what markets are we talking about? And you can organize your thinking quite differently here. First of all, there are different markets in terms of whether you're talking about consumers or business. And when you refer to cable, predominantly you're talking about consumers, not business customers. This is a whole different set of microeconomics. The physics of the industry are different there than the physics of getting into the home. So we're talking about consumers. Secondly, there is a notion of the physical assets that are employed in this industry to bring access to the home, and the logical. And he described the difference between having a server and a PC and a disk going over some physical resource, but in essence, he's got a very artful, logical business. It's defined by software, it's defined by computers, and it happens to organize the physical assets to provide the service. And there's a physical side of the market. The physical side is like a cable, it's wireless, fixed wireless, or mobile wireless, it's narrowband, metallic loops like Edge Company, and there's a technology to drive that technology, either electronics, or optoelectronics, or fiber. So you've got all kinds of technologies there. What's the objective? If the objective is to drive consumer choice, the way I would look at it, and where I spend most of my time, is looking at what's going on in the accelerating velocity of wireless solutions to the home, broadband wireless, which is coming very quickly, XDSL over the metallic loops, there is broadband to the home over cable, and frankly, there are a number of overbuilders who are now lashing fiber over the cable holes that get pulling fiber close to the home. So there's companies that compete with the cable companies on the same routes that the cable companies use. So if our objective is to promote competition in the service of customers, offer them choice, I'd argue that we've got to be concerned about how the capital is being formed and the companies are being formed to bring the alternate physical resources to the home in addition to the logical resources. And the way you deal with that is to ensure that the companies are incented to invest. The cable plant's in a unique position. It is, in effect, being used, at least in AT&T's case, to bring telephony to the home, keep it in. At the same time, it has internet access on it, which is not defined as a telephony service, so it's not regulated, and it's not within the bounds of the television regulations or cable TV regulations, so it's a service that's not regulated at the moment. There's no law that requires AT&T or the cable companies to open it up. And then you got programmed entertainment also going with the cable plant. So you got three different industries coming over the cable plant, which I think Charles adequately describes as coming together. They're converging. The robustness of all these access technologies will allow a lot of choice for companies like Charles to find multiple paths to the home. There is a lot of competition coming to the cable companies as well as Edge Company. And if you look at the Wall Street today, look at the financial markets, and look at what the multiples are going on the stocks and how money is being formed, there's a lot, tremendous amount of economic fueling going on to bring these alternatives in. If you were to open up the cable plant just without any considerations of that factor, I think you're going to pierce the economic power behind what's driving the cable plant to be enhanced itself. Cable industry is going to spend somewhere around $35 billion. Number one, increase the bandwidth to the home, then bring technologies to make it go two-way, then the technologies to make it go digital, then the technologies to drive internet access, then the technologies to have telephony. That's a big price tag. If you're going to open it up, you're going to make taxpayers pay for it rather than investors.
So John makes two points. He makes one point primarily directed to Charles, and the second point maybe is something Jim could speak to. Now, the first point for Charles is, look, why should the consumer care? You said the consumer says, hi, I'd like to call somebody on the phone, and get me internet. And the person on the other end says, great, you can have DSL, you can have cable modem, would you like wireless? And the consumer says, get me internet. And you realize that from the point of view of the internet, TCP/IP, the magic of internet is it can fly over any medium, and it doesn't particularly care what the medium is. So John is saying, look, you've got a great deal of ad. You're going to get your business into the home, even when dial-up withers and dies. It's true you're a buggy whip manufacturer now, but that's okay because here's another public transportation business that you can get a piece of. So why do you need a piece of his too? I mean, should the consumer really care whether it's through one particular kind of coaxial cable or some other twisted pair or metal loops wrapped around phone poles? I haven't seen that yet, but I mean, why should it matter to the consumer which medium is carrying their packets?
Well, they care what the medium is, because some mediums will perform very differently than others, and there are going to be a lot of homes that can only get broadband through cable for a long time.
How long is a long time, then?
Many years, maybe. And there's this question of what other technologies are sort of racing to the rescue to provide broadband connectivity to homes is a very important one. If you really think that, lo and behold, in a couple of years we're going to have half dozen pathways to the home, it's a very different sort of situation than if you think they're really going to be only one or two. And I would love to hear about the other technologies coming that will provide service which really is broadband, really is two-way, broadband two-way, all packet, and is available at a consumer price point, because I would be one of the most eager consumers of this technology in the whole world, and I don't see it. All the alternatives that I'm aware of come up short on one of those three. They're either not really broadband, like, for example, Metricom. They're not really two-way, like, for example, DirectPC. Or they're not available at a consumer price point, which is the case for many, many wireless or T1 replacement business sorts of products. And ones that meet all three, the list is zero. It's back to the cable wire, the phone company wire.
So again, you're just wanting to hedge your bets across as many media as possible, because it's hard to say which one may be dominant, and the dominance may hinge on the medium after all, on what kind of cable it is.
No, I would disagree with your assessment, your summary of what I just said. I mean, what I'm saying is that there are only going to be a pathway or two into most homes, and for a lot of homes for a long time, only one. So if we want to be able to serve those customers, we better be able to use it. And if those customers want to have any choice at all, they better be able to get a choice of different service providers that deliver the service through that single wire.
Does that sound right, Ed? Basically, he's saying, you're great, it's a nice kind of compact, but this is the guy who's going to be in a lot of homes that you're not possibly going to reach through DSL in the next many years. So, I mean, does that worry you? Aren't you worried that you want a piece of the cable action, too?
Well, I mean, obviously, the more options you have, the consumers have, the better the situation is. So the fact of the matter is that in this country, most people who want a cell phone can get a cell phone. Charles is right. And so for many consumers, the telephone is going to be the only information highway that they have, realistically. And what we're looking for is rules that put us on parity, so we have the same economic incentives to upgrade that network to provide broadband selected. So
what kinds of rules are these, just to get them out?
Well, for example, under the 96 Act, one of the things that we have to do, ironically, is unbundle our network so that people can come in and compete with us in three ways. They can either build their own facilities completely, and that's what John and TCI are doing. They can buy unbundled network elements from us, that is, we have switches in our network, we have the loops that go out to your house, we have the trunking that goes between our central offices. So if you have a switch and you don't have access to loops or trunking, you can buy those from us, basically at an incremental portion of the cost. And then the third way is you can just resell our existing service, package it with your own. Charles could have, Mindspring phone service, where he would get phone service from us, resell it with his internet service.
So this is like 1010 Lucky Dog Mindspring.
That's another way of actually getting access to long distance networks. But it's the same. The idea is you package your service with others.
And when you say incremental costs, who decides what the right cost is?
The FCC, under the recent court decision, does that with some help from the states who actually implement the FCC's guidelines. The challenge here, though, is that this is ironic. John's sitting down there saying, if I have to open my network up, I don't have the economic incentives to compete or to make the investment. I'm required by the law to open up my networks, and we're struggling to provide these services. So, one of the
things. But is that sort of misery loves company? You want John to suffer just as you are, or you're saying throw the yoke off me?
Throw the yoke off me. We're beyond trying to shackle.
There are different levels of yoke, right? And the ILEC is the heaviest yoke, without doubt. All other telecom companies, including all competitive local exchange carriers and all long-distance companies, have a set of regulations that they live by as a telecommunications company. They're generally perceived, as I think, as not horribly onerous, but they do include things like interconnection requirements, some non-discriminatory access, and some sort of fair resale sort of provisions. And so all the CLECs that are coming in with, you know, now some incredible valuations and incredible flow of capital, they're all subject to these requirements. It does not appear to be an impediment in any way to them building their businesses. There's a tremendous flow of capital to them. So somehow there's this notion that if you have to run a telecommunications company like any other telecommunications company, you can't get capital to do it when it comes to the cable industry.
Hold on, I think
I've got
to structure the problem, right? He can be academic about it. Jim may be able to help here. We just complained that.
Jim wants to hide under the table.
We just conflated some markets. If we get back to some of the things, we confused them. If we're talking about telecommunications, let me separate that from the internet. The Telecommunications Act of 96 and the divestiture in 1984, which and my brother and I separated, had some different motives that the government had at the time, as well as Judge Green, et cetera. Here you've got the Act of 96, in effect, at the highest level, says to the RBOC, the ILEX, that you have a monopoly.
RBOC, Regional Bell Operating Company. Okay, that's people like Edward, just trying to keep the players straight.
You don't have to open up your networks unless you want to go into long distance. You can sit there and not open up the network unless you want to go into long distance. And in fact, if you don't open up the networks, people will invest, you know, like we are, to present competition.
Excuse me, I cannot let this go.
That's what I like. Hold your outrage.
I'm not outrage, it's actual.
I'm trying to refer to Jim to help us out here. But the point is that now you've got disciplines and perspective on it. In AT&T's case, we've got something like 140 long distance switches in our network. And that network feeds into the switches that go to the home. And there are something like 22,000 RBOC switches in the country. To think of any company, long distance company, be it Sprint, MCI, ourselves, that have enough money to replicate that infrastructure and the things we talk about is absolutely absurd. It's kind of capital formation to do it. So what's going on here is really how do you want to construct the inducements to create customer choice? There is no local service choice for the most part in this country for consumers.
Unless you're doing the deal where you get to rent some of his switch at a rate settled by the FCC and then
or,
your own.
Or you take on the task to build it, which is what we're doing. We're using that cable plant primarily to get to the consumer to give them choice for telephone service. Multiple lines in the home rather than the average of 1.2 lines today. So we're committing our balance sheet and our investor dollar to go reform all these plants to present a telephone service of better value to the consumer than we believe our competition does in this case. And this company is going to react to that. They should invest to improve their plant. They have technology to do that. So as a result, we've got the cable plant being brought to the market to compete, provide better telephone service, in addition to the other things that Charles referred to. And if you were to open up the plant to willy-nilly allow everybody to use it without allowing us to invest to capture the value of having done it, you remove all the incentives, not on the flow. On the other hand, if you look at where Ed's taken it, he's got the open telephone service. How do you present competition? It's such a difficult mass investment to go at it. And the argument is, thank you. The argument is, look, if you want to go on the long distance, what we're learning is that customers really want all distance. They don't want local and long distance. They don't discriminate between the distance and the length of a call. They want the convenience of all distance.
They want an integrated network.
Well, they want an integrated offer.
Among multiple competing networks.
They want an integrated offer, and they want choice for an integrated offer. All distance. It goes into long distance, you can provide all distance. for Ed to go into log distance, merely has to flip some switches in his network, an externally software. He can rent the backbone network from Quest, from Level 3, from Williams, from AT&T, from MCI, from Sprint. He's got five choices to rent the backbone network because our industry is competitive. We only have one place if we want to rent a network to go in, and it's him. So the question is, how do you open up that network on a fair basis to do it? Or if you're not going to open up the network, don't go into long distance and sit there as a monopoly. Or if you know you want service for alternative forms, somebody's got to build it, and that's what we're doing with the cable company. And if you open that up prematurely, you remove all the incentive for that to form.
So that might give you your chance to run.
Under the Telecom Act of 1996, Section 251 requires us to open up our networks, regardless of whether they're going to long distance. So we just can't sit there, back down and happy with our local monopoly and rake in the enormous profits, which is sort of the urban myth.
That was the old days. Boy, were those good.
So what we have to do today is we have to open up our networks, incur the cost of opening them up. You know, we can fight about whether or not the rates that we are allowed to charge for those network elements recoup that cost without sort of water under the bridge over the dam that we use. The fact of the matter is that we have to open up those networks. We have to incur that investment. So obviously that gives us a greater incentive to look for other revenue sources, including long distance. And so we're going to do that, and we're doing that as fast as we can. John mentioned the challenge of replicating our infrastructure. We wouldn't replicate our infrastructure if we were going in on a clean slate. You know, our network was designed in the 60s and 70s with the advent.
Is that 1850s or
1900s? The telegraph lines and anyway, during the 1960s and 70s, sort of with the advent of automated switches as opposed to operators switching calls. And so when that happened, we designed a network based on that, and that's why we have all the facilities that we have. And that's investment that, you know, was subsidized at the time in the interest of getting everybody telephone service. So now the challenge is to upgrade that antiquated structure, put in digital switches, put in new facilities, interoperable facilities, facilities between the switches that facilitate high-speed connection and offer services to Charlotte and others. We don't pretend to want to We have no aspirations to dominate the ISP market. In fact, our Bell Atlantic Net, our own internet service provider, has a whopping 100,000 customers or something. We're just not, that's just not our business. And so as Charles
said, so you're sort of doing it half-heartedly.
Well, you know, we have these ideas that we can do these things, and then we find out they're not as easy as we think they are. But the point is that there are lots of companies like Charles that have lots of applications that can use high-speed connections. So what we're trying to do is facilitate that. But the rules are working against us, and there's an issue now that the FCC has to deal with, and that is we want to devise the internet service providers like Charles enjoy a special privilege under the FCC's rules, and that is they're treated like end users. They're not treated like customers. They're not treated like carriers like AT&T. So when they buy services from us, they don't have to pay the per minute rates that carriers like AT&T pay. They pay a flat rate for connections so they can offer internet service. Well, that special position is hurting them and us in a new context, and that is we want to offer volume discounts for this DSL service, this high-speed data service over our network. But under the 96 Act, remember I told you there was sort of the wholesale way of getting into business where you buy bits and pieces and offer your own service, and there's resale. Well, there's specified discounts for resale, there's a way you measure discounts for resale. And if I offer any telecommunication service to a customer, I also have to offer it at a discount so that others can resell it. Well, if I want to do a million line deal with Charles, which says, you know, here's the rate for DSL service, and you can get a million lines or 100,000 lines or some discount, I then have to discount off of that because he's considered an end user customer, not a wholesaler. I then have to make a further discount off of that so that someone like John or others can come in and get that same service. So there's no incentive for Charles to try to negotiate with me because whatever rate he negotiates with me, other carriers can come in and get that rate at a discount. This is one of the anomalies of trying to cram an internet, a high-speed data type offering to traditional telephone rules. And, you know, part of the challenge here is to find some balance between modifying the legislation and working with the FCC to recognize that, you know, this is a whole different game.
Of course, another way of phrasing it is, to the extent that you're sitting on top of, I won't use the M word, to the extent that you're sitting on top of something that no one else has, you can't cut favored deals with one gold partner, Charles, Link the Lottery, and then no one else.
No, it's not a favored deal. Anybody, this is a tariff offering. Anybody can come in.
No, I understand. That's how it is now. But you're saying.
No, even under the proposal that we're making, like,
I'm going
to say, Charles, I have to make that available to everybody.
Just not at an extra discount, you're saying.
It's the same terms and conditions. The challenge is how do you recognize that he's really not a customer. You know, Charles is not going to use those million lines in his office building, right? He's going to, customers are going to sign up for the service. So, you know, we have to get rid of these traditional notions of who's a carrier, who's an end user, who's a customer, and recognize in today's marketplace and today's technology, people can use the same set of services for a variety of different applications.
So, Jim, you have a very hard job. I know, I think we're all coming to understand that sort of a stream of people come in, they've got problems, Congress screwed up here, there's competition that's failing here, too much subsidy over there, and you're supposed to, in the name of the public interest, sift through all this and figure out what's supposed to happen. So we have at least two problems that have piled up even just this morning. One, which Ed just described, Joy attempt to recharacterize, and the first problem was what John said, which was, and here I will attempt to recharacterize it, we're putting a lot of money into doing this parallel extra network that will come into your home through cable, and we're under the shadow of the possibility that we're suddenly going to have to open it up. And we have to open it up. I'm VP of strategy. I'd have a whole different strategy if that was going to happen than I would if it isn't going to happen. So now there's just this shadow, and I don't know if the boot was going to land on me or if it's going to step 3 feet to the right of me. And that's no way to have to operate a business when the margins are in the billions versus one decision versus another. So maybe in reverse order, if you could address John's point, the specter of regulation coming down, for which he can't properly organize his affairs because he doesn't know what's going to happen, and then his point.
Well, generally speaking, I think the Commission has tried to be mindful of the needs of capital formation, and but at the same time tried to have rules that will promote competition and innovation, and that's one of the tensions that we face. Another one of the tensions that we face, as these people or their organizations are, as the Commission arguing before us every day, is that the telecommunications and information industries are changing very quickly. This argument wasn't fully anticipated by the 1996 Act. Senator Pressler here can tell you a lot more about it than he's forgotten more about it than I'll ever know, but you know, they were trying to write an act that dealt with changes that had occurred over past years and trying to anticipate the kinds of changes that were coming in future years. One proposal that the Congress considered but did not adopt was to have a separate title of the act that was called, like, Title VII, and it would have been a title that would deal with advanced broadband, two-way, switch, multimedia, whatever, and kind of have some sort of harmonized regulatory, but mostly deregulatory, scheme for that. Congress didn't adopt such a proposal, and the act we have has the traditional titles, Title II for telecommunications, and Title III for broadcasting and other radio licenses, and Title VI for cable. So we kind of have these different structures that we, different titles and different heritages of regulation for each of the different areas, and yet we really are now seeing some convergence here as these businesses are all kind of wanting to do things that are more like what the others are doing. I mean, convergence is sometimes overstated because the FCC has been talking about convergence of computers and communications for, I don't know, since the early 70s, I think. And that trend's been underway, but it still remains the case that you can tell Compaq Corporation apart from Bell Atlantic. I mean, I haven't converged yet. But there is clearly convergence in the broadband area. And trying to figure out how you take an act that is basically a Title II and a Title III and a Title VI and then deal with what people portray as I mean, some will say it's anomalous. They'll say it's pretty darn anomalous. I've got to open up my network and make resale available at wholesale rates and this and that. And yet they don't. They want to run a closed shop over there. They'll tell us that the they'll scuttle their acquisition of TCI with its potential for more competition and telephony services if we intrude prematurely over there. So the commission struggles with these as best it can, and it does so within the framework of this law as it was passed, and not with any thought about what we might prefer it to say, even if we had the right answer to that. So we struggle with it. But first and foremost, the commission has pushed for competition. We've tried to do those things that will get us to competition, and then we do hold out greater hopes than Charles does for a multiplicity of broadband pathways to the home. And we hope that that may get us the openness, make the environment in which we will have the openness that has made the internet the wonder that it is. And we want to continue to have the choice of ISPs that people have today in an environment in which the infrastructure provides you multiple pathways. That may be the case. But as far as the uncertainty of what the FCC may do in the future or what Congress may do in the future, that is an uncertainty that, you know, we all talk about the desirability of avoiding regulatory risk, but it is also the case that Congress particularly is a reactive institution. And so, and laws change, and that's a given, and it's part of what people have to take into account as they go along. But I think that the general proposition that government has been trying to do more for competition and less in the way of regulation is probably a pretty clear message that comes from all the commissioners and all the congressmen, even though among them there are a number of differences of view.
Well, so the clearest, I know your answer is, it's really hard. It's impossible. We get a lot of things we have to think hard about and hopefully do the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that the FCC is suited as an institution to deal with these issues quickly enough? I mean, I can imagine one way to deal with it is through a sort of paralysis, to just hope it all works out, so you be more optimistic about the future than nobody can predict, and just hope it all comes out in the wash, and maybe Congress will end up reacting, at which point you'll have to implement whatever Congress says. But how far out of a limb is FCC able to go in actually fashioning a solution that might really rain on John's parade or not? And do you think the FCC is well suited to do this in a fleet manner, one that is somehow responsive to just how quickly the field is changing?
I personally think that the agency is well designed and well peopled with the right kinds of talent. I believe it is capable of making wise decisions on a timely basis. It has, as I mentioned, a variety of points of view represented among its five members, and it's got an incredibly able staff, and it does have to struggle with some of these decisions. Congress, in a number of cases, has said you've got to decide these kinds of things in 3 months, and these in 180 days, and there are a lot of deadlines in this act, a lot more than there used to be. And those have tended to force some decisions. They also have tended to mean that certain other things that aren't subject to a deadline may get pushed aside briefly, shunted onto a siding while one of those statutory deadline items is worked on. But generally speaking, I think the Commission has shown itself to be capable of rendering timely decisions, as it happens in the case of this issue that we've been talking about. The Commission has for the time being, decided not to intervene in any way. The commission has said we see a whole. We're very early in the evolution of the broadband marketplace. I think at the time the commission put its first broadband report out in February, 0.4% of Americans had broadband. You know, were subscribers to a broadband service. We're very early in this, but there's so much investment going on and so much. So the growth is so fast I think the collective view was let's see what happens. Let's let this go. So the commission did not speak to this issue of is this really more properly classified as a Title II versus a Title VI offering. It just punted and said, we're going to keep an eye on this, but we are just not going to jump in with both feet. So that's where it is right now.
So for the rest of you who either currently labor or may at some point labor under the yoke of regulation flowing either from the FCC or from the law itself coming from Congress, is this system working? I mean, there's part of Jim's point is, look, Crimea River, you've got to deal with certain uncertainties that come up in a regulatory environment where precisely billions of dollars are at stake, and we're doing what we can to provide competition in the marketplace. So knowing that that's where he's coming from in his shoes, John, is it functioning as far as you can tell? Are you pretty happy with the structure it is? You plead your case before the FCC. In this case, it comes out pretty well for the time being, and then you move on. Ed may have a different story to tell, particularly with this desire to compete in the law business market. So I'd like to hear those stories. And yeah. Charles, too.
I think if you step back from it, I think what this puts into relief is a very difficult job that Jim has. But in answer to that, I think they've been doing it well. And I say that to say, if you step back and look at the telecom market worldwide and how other nation states have evolved, generally, particularly, for example, in Europe, you see the telecom companies being a taxing medium on society. So France Telecom has its rate set, so the French industrial policy is to fund the computer industry. We don't do that here.
We have no taxes imposed to fund or subsidize other areas within the system.
I'm getting there. We don't do it that way. So as a result, if you look at, for example, how telecom service works in other countries, there is a distinction, and this is not to advocate the U.S. as having the right answer for everything, but we've got to be mindful of other societies. But I think our policy making here has been pretty good compared to what I've seen around the world, and I spend a lot of time doing that. Furthermore, Jim touched on something, as did Ed. We did introduce, I can't remember exactly, an expert in how all the regulations have come about in the laws, but there was a reference to what was called the enhanced service provider exemption, which allows Charles to have a certain rate to use his plant to provide internet access. And so if you look at internet access in other countries of the world, the prices our consumers are paying to get internet access is much different than what they would pay in Germany, France, and England, and Japan. And as a result, we've had burgeoning internet. In fact, the United States has predominance of web traffic around the world. So we've cultivated a market position that enhances the internet community here more than any other country has for the most part. I think it's 40% of the internet traffic emanates and terminates in California. And so you've got a tremendous burgeoning economy here. Now, the reason that is an issue is it gets to the subsidy point. And that is, and I think Ed said it, the long distance companies are paying so much to complete a call through the telecom plan to get to, that's called an access charge. And Charles is not paying that. So he's able to present internet access to a consumer in a way that's attractive, whereas we are funding some of the capital formation within Bell Atlantic to provide the XDSO funding and all those other things that they want to do to refurbish their structure. And at the same time, you get caught up in that kind of argument. So I'm not suggesting that we have some, it's perfect. And that there aren't debates, because I know that'll come back on me on that one. But on balance, I think Jim described it very well. Let's use our market rules to form the interests of monies and talents and people, create companies. They're able to bring as much of technological and economic resource to the consumer. Let's judge how it's going. Let's not artificially intervene. Let's not have undue regulation, but let's protect the consumer. Let's make sure the markets are working. But don't get in the way unless you for sure know that it's not. And so I think AT&T would have its beefs for sure on some of the issues that Jim and me debate and we debate. But on balance, I'd say we're feeling good about the direction. We would note, for example, that the FCC supported the GCI merger. But the question is, should have, frankly, what value did the consumer get out of Bell Atlantic and NYMEX merging?
What benefit does the consumer get by SBC managing with Pac-Bell and then Southern New England Telephone and now Ameritech? What does the consumer get for that? Where is the competition coming from for that kind of activity? How does that work? So I could raise a bunch of issues. The first point is
everybody's working with my own in the disaster.
Yeah. I think that we got to be mindful that we have the chance, and that's why my opening comment was, let's be very careful about the motives we have here. If we're trying to induce competition to serve the consumer, we're trying to encourage capital markets and technology companies to do that. That is the primary goal.
So we've got this one way you might end up getting into Ed's core business, his meat and potatoes, possibly through offering regular old telephone service from the point of view of the consumer through a cable modem, puts it over TCP/IP, boom, through the internet, and then ending either in yet another internet connection, somebody else who happens to be an AT&T PCI customer, or even, thanks to the magic of computers, just through a regular old phone call, local switch on the far end. Is that some way in which you may be digging into his business and not facing the regulation that he does over his local switch?
Do you mean telephony over the internet?
Correct.
That we're going? Well, look, technology, I think we need to look at technology as presenting opportunities. And the velocity of technology is accelerating so much that it'd be folly for any company to hold back what consumers and inventiveness of Silicon Valley is going to do. So our attitude is if a consumer finds value in making a telephone call over the internet and bypassing the system, that's their choice and that's going to be a market. How do we participate in that market, even although it'll cannibalize our current business? And so the issue is if the technology is going to unlock and in fact cannibalize the business you're running today, you better hurry up and jump on that technology wave and do it to yourself first.
Right. I want to give you a chance to just briefly say a few words, and there's a couple more directions I want to take, and then actually throw it out to the audience so people should be thinking of questions they want to ask.
Let's start with the fact that the FCC cannot issue an order these days without saying we're not charging people for using the internet. This is a big problem that the FCC has to deal with, because as it tries to resolve these issues between inter-exchange carriers and local exchange carriers, and companies like Charles are trying to use those facilities to provide internet service, as you shift the responsibility for cost recovery from one pocket to another, from one company to another, we're dancing around this issue of, you know, what do we do about the internet? It's growing at a phenomenal rate. We're having to put in facilities to support it. And the question is, how do you allow cost recovery but maintain special rules for Charles so he doesn't have to pay the inter-exchange rates? And by the way, I think everyone, well, maybe John would disagree, but I think the point is that no one wants to tax the internet. This is an engine of our economy. It's going great guns. There seems to be the law of scarcity doesn't seem to apply. Whatever you can come up with, there's a market for it. You know, you've got new startups going all the time. So no one wants to stop this engine. But yet there's real money being expended here. And the question is, can you come up with a logical regime for recovering those costs that doesn't unduly burden the internet and doesn't create an equity that's between one set of carriers and another set of carriers? So I really do sympathize with Jim and the decisions he has to make, because there aren't a lot of answers here. And the real answer, I think, has to go back to Congress, Larry. I think what we have to do is recognize that, you know, the internet is a tax-free zone. We have to recognize that there's going to be no regulation of the offering of internet services, so that all companies can offer, use their best efforts to offer internet services in the most economically efficient and rational way, unfettered by these sorts of diseconomies that result from unequal regulation. So I think that that's the real answer to the internet challenge, is we need legislation.
Presuming no massive regulatory changes, do you see, I can imagine, the one thing the consumer wants, as you just described the hot button, is, you know, don't start taxing my internet. That could also be read to say, look, I'm happy with a flat rate. I'll pay somebody $20 a month, and I don't want to have clocked when I visit one site versus another, or I just sent more than my 50 email limit, et cetera, et cetera. Is the free lunch that's represented by unlimited bandwidth, or not unlimited bandwidth, but unlimited usage, within a bandwidth that isn't strictly measured, that any customer might enjoy. You have somebody on a cable modem right now happily serving up photos of them working at their desk to the world at large, taking up some serious bandwidth for which they are not being charged a differential price. That's a wonderful world for the consumer. Is that a world that is likely to stick around?
Well, I think that where the revenues are on the internet are in the e-commerce realm, okay? And those revenues are growing phenomenally as people realize that they don't have to get in their polluting vehicles and drive downtown and park in an asphalt parking lot and buy goods and services, and the fact that they can do that from their homes. And so it's providing both an environmental benefit as well as economic benefit.
Everybody's huddling their house, not ruining it.
I mean, there's also a lot of issues that also flows from that. But the point is that consumers do want the kind of world that you described. And I think that where we can allow that bandwidth to occur is because the revenues that companies are getting from the other types of transactions that are going on in the internet. So, you know, in the days of nuclear energy, it's going to be too cheap to meter. And one might argue that in the future, the internet is going to be too cheap, right, to charge the meter, to charge for the services, that even your flat 1995 or whatever we're paying today may disappear as people are more interested in selling you things and getting your eyeballs to look at things than the connections themselves. So, but that suggests that we have to evolve our business from just a network business to a content business that gets into these issues, into these enterprises as well. And that's where John is going with his business as well. So I think that there is a model that left unregulated that would allow consumers to continue to get the benefits of getting today, and even more. There are a lot of services that Charles and others would like to offer if they could get 24-hour high-speed access to their home. I mean, streaming audio, streaming video, all kinds of things could become available. So there's more to come. And the question is, what's the fair playing field so that everyone can offer those services?
So Charles, that's a softball over to you on the fair playing field. You've been wanting to get in for a while anyway.
Yeah, I think that a lot of good points have been made in the last couple of remarks here. I think a lot of we have done some brilliant things about our telecommunication policy, there's no doubt, and I think the internet access market itself is such a great example of a market that's really worked wonderfully, and there's this separation between the underlying telecommunications infrastructure, you know, the bit-carrying machinery on the one hand, and the service that you buy on the other, and in today's world, most everybody at home connects through the bit carrying infrastructure goes through the local phone network as a phone call for the last mile, and then a variety of wide area connectivity beyond that. And generally speaking, the underlying telecom infrastructure is regulated as a telecommunications service, right, in the terms of the law, whereas the internet service is regulated as an information service, which means basically it's not regulated.
And you're loving the FCC right now.
Well, it seems to work pretty darn well. And for things like contributing to the Universal Access Fund, for example, telecommunication services pay into that and take out of that. Information services don't. And it's just, so it sort of insulates the internet from a lot of the regulatory issues, some of which need to continue to be in place. I think it's a great structure. And having that sort of transfer toward the world of broadband, I think, is one of the keys that we're talking about.
Now, we're so honored to have basically these barons at the table representing such powerful interests. You're a baron too, George, really. So, there's some interest not at the table. Yeah. There are some interests not at the table that I just want to ask you all quickly about. Interest number one, when you think of the internet, one of the magic of it is that TCP/IP is a fundamental protocol on which the internet rides, is wholly independent of the physical media that you respectively represent to some extent, that are the different ways of getting it into the home and across the network. So the IETF is a group of engineers. They meet somewhat informally. When they want to make a decision, they hum. You aware of this? When they want to make a decision, they hum, because you can't hum particularly loud or particularly quietly. And whoever hears the loudest hum, I guess whoever's chairing the meeting at that moment in time, says, okay, the hums have it, and we have a new decision. And thus is a new internet protocol born. And they're constantly revising this protocol. IPv6, IPv7, IPv8. Are there ramifications? Are there things the IETF can do? Or put more broadly, are there ways in which internet protocols can evolve that bear on your businesses, that bear on the kinds of services that you strategically might plan to offer or not, either right down the level of the wire that has been so conveniently divorced from the protocol, or otherwise, as each of you is getting into the eyeball and content business? And if so, are you wanting to dispatch some talented hummers to these kinds of meetings where these things are getting formed in order to have some role? I mean, you know how to lobby on Congress, you know how to state your case before the FCC. Is this a world that you need to be paying attention to the lobbying, or, hey, that's just the internet, that'll take care of itself, we just need to offer broadband connectivity? Yeah, sure, man.
In my closet, I've got an 8-track tape player, Sony Betamax, a video disc player. I mean, it seems to me that in this century, or in the latter part of the century, what's happened is people try out new technologies. Some stick, some don't. And those that stick, ultimately, standard evolves around them, and then you go forward until somebody comes up with the next best thing. And I think that our view, at least, is that's the way it should continue. That is, that a disaster, if I can give you an example, I think Jim might even agree with this, was HDTV. I don't know how long have you guys tried to come up with an industry standard for HDTV. It's been like, at least 10 years or more. And that's what happens when you say, don't offer anything until we come up with a standard. All right, now obviously companies have to make significant investments in new technology, and so they have to sort of bet where they think things are going to come out. But I think from the consumer standpoint at least, while I might be mad that I chose wrong, chose poorly, and chose a Betamax over a VHS, but the fact of the matter is, in the long run, standards do develop. But it also allows for niche people to come up with their own applications. Now, I think a different example is this MP3 audio streaming technology. For those who aren't aware, there is a technology that has been developed on the internet that allows the transmission, probably this group is aware, allows the transmission.
Not being displayed via those around.
Music. Copyrighted music, it can be downloaded and shared and passed around. And so you can bypass record producers, distribution companies, those sorts of things. And there's a number of lawsuits that have evolved recently, or have been created recently as a result of this. And so you have the music production industry saying, we've got to have something, we've got to have proprietary software so we can preserve our management fees that we get by distributing records. And you have the content creators saying, I want to be able to share my content, and I'd rather get 50 cents from a million people than have to share the revenues that I get with my producers. So you have those kinds of debates going on.
And do you have a dog in that fight?
I have no dog in that fight. The only dog I have is I would like to be the one that helps distribute content, whatever is there.
And in fact, the more content, the better, because the more demand for content distribution services.
Exactly.
Other reactions?
Yeah, I'm actually going to surprise you, but Ed and I, you know about that.
Should we take a picture?
That's a pressing question, if I understand, because you're moving into the zone of software in Microsoft.
That was my next question.
I know. what the challenge is getting at, what Ed was getting at, is that what's happening now is that you've got the convergence, so-called convergence of the telecom sector, the web marketplace, and video entertainment marketplace as the mediums coming together, and the devices and the underlying technology and equipment that are used going forward are really distributed computing platforms. they're no longer the telephone switches that the telecom industry used to make, where Lucent and Nortel or Siemens or Alcatel, all the equipment manufacturers around the world making those telecom equipment, had a set of standards, and used to go to Geneva and how they interconnected and all that stuff, because they had a worldwide telephone system where, frankly, if you were a customer of AT&T or Bell or anything, you could make a call and would complete in France without a phone. Very complex thing to do, and you had to have an understanding among the manufacturers and the telecom guys how to make all that work. It took a lot of time to get that done, and our societies really benefited from it. Now, all of a sudden, as Charles says, I thought he did the answer a moment ago, it was very great. What it said was, there is a separation now. You've got this telecom thing working. And on top of it now, you have companies like Charles and AOL, Microsoft Network, the web community itself. They're using that platform, but what they're really doing is directing the traffic through a set of computers now. And these computers have downsized themselves and become cheaper. And for the first time with a computer, you've got a screen. And the screen presents an image. So graphics now in video. It's no longer just ears. You've actually got an enriched ability to communicate, either access information, communicate as between each other, or multiple points of contact. And it's all being brought forward by the computer industry, laying on top of the old telecom sector. So you find now the new suppliers that we're doing business with are less Lucent and less Nortel, now Cisco and Sun Microsystems. So now this distributed computing platform gets built, the organization of that and how it's managed is very different. And the standards, we used to go to Geneva for to debate with all the international telephone companies, are being developed now in a very competitive market context where there is no standard making. IP, Internet Protocol, TCP/IP, is an open standard. So whoever races forward first with an idea how to make a PC do something differently with a computer that connects to other PCs ends up creating a little interface that allows the software to manipulate the screen and send some information in a unique way, like complete a phone call, to somebody else. All of a sudden, as many people can proliferate and jump on that standard, they end up creating a new market. And it's a rudderless market, and it's very ad hoc and diffuse. But the industry itself ultimately hits on a standard. So the MP3 standard is for distributing streaming audio. They're streaming video. Yahoo just brought on broadcast.com. Why? They see they're going to compete with the cable guys. They want to send video over the internet. They're going to want to go over broadband to do that too. And so all of a sudden, the computer industry is very interested in how this is working, because they can proliferate devices. They keep downsizing the devices and make smaller and sub-$1,000 PCs into the home, working on narrowband or broadband. If we were to be, and I don't think this is going to happen, but if Microsoft were to subsume the industry standard and take its software and put it through all of these telecom networks, they could do to the telecom industry what they did to the PC industry, which is create a new monopoly in software. Very controlling choke point. We don't want that to happen. Well, the same thing could happen with Cisco. The same thing could happen with Sun. The beauty of IP protocols is it works against it, because in some total of the innovation in the industry, I think a lot depends on your individual firm. So now we're competing on the merits of understanding customers, taking the technologies of the computer industry, putting them on top of the telecom industry, and creating new value. And I think that's what, in essence, they're the same. There's a race on here to figure out what customers want and how to organize the industry to get there. I say that to say, look at the stock market over the last 6 months. Why is AOL, with a revenue stream of $2 billion, worth as much as IBM? Why are the rumors that AOL may buy CBS? It's because the stock market's betting that these companies who understand this technology, who understand customers very well, are the ones that will end up reorganizing how all the rest of it gets done. Amazon.com, same thing. Yahoo, I mean, these guys got revenue streams and hardly make a profit, yet they're worth $3 billion.
And this is the world you're happy with, right? You feel comfortable in this world.
It's a reality. It's not a question of whether I like it or not. I happen to, personally. It's not a question of whether I like it or not. It's a reality. And therefore, you come to grips with it. You've got to redo your business strategies. You've got to redo your business models. You've got to make money differently. Whether it's flat rate or usage sensitive, it doesn't matter. Keep your eye on the customer and organize the technologies the best you can, as quickly as you can, to get there.
Now, among these, any other thoughts on that? You guys want to speak to the
quick comment?
Yeah, sure.
The FCC in 1980 said customer premises equipment and enhanced services were just, people don't believe that governments do these things, but just we're taking them out of our regulatory reach. They're no longer Title II offerings. We will not regulate them, and thus it has been ever since, and that's part of why you're getting all the investment and innovation that's been discussed here.
And are the states displaced from doing it themselves too?
Yeah, it was not just the FCC tying its own hands. It was the FCC ousting the states from regulating these things as well. And, you know, back then in 1980, you know, a 9600 bit per second modem cost you 10 grand. It was a buck a bit. So,
you could use it for a long time.
So, yeah, and it was good for selling lines. You know, if you were selling lines, people had to buy a lot of lines just to do very little. So the FCC has nothing to say about these group of Hummers or anything. I think that most of the commissioners, I mentioned before, there are multiple different points of view. I suspect, though, that they probably all disagree with that comment about DTV, but that's not what we're here to talk about today. But I just want to, just for the record,
yeah, it'll be duly noted.
That's a very different market, and the role that the commission played, you know, was a catalyst for industry was probably a constructive one. It was not a heavy-handed one, but if it was a constructive one, it might be.
It took us 20 years to get cellular TV. I mean,
cellular TV,
having the market open too. So I mean,
cellular TV, just go with pile calling. So some of the standards, just to finish up on this IETF point too, and in some ways the Microsoft point has been spoken to. Some of these standards bear ultimately on consumer choice and on what people using the internet can do and what ways they are constrained or not as they go about it. Privacy may be a great example. Maybe I should ask Charles, is one of the ways you could imagine, one of the axes along which you could differentiate your service, were you offering it through John's cable or over Ed's DSL network? Could you say, and by the way, we don't assign you a permanent IP address and a permanent domain name that is yours that would then mark you as you wander around the internet. We will anonymize you. Is that the level at which you could imagine competing down to those protocols that bear on what might be consumer preference as you differentiate your service along pipes that everybody else may be trying to offer too?
Clearly, privacy policies, yes. It might come down to some technical issues. I suppose it might. And this is not really sort of a far-off theoretical issue. Another one is terms of service. And it's actually come up with at home, I'm sure John knows, but privacy policy that various users found to be very objectionable. And also terms of service, which sort of apparently forbade the use of the connection for various business-related purposes, which were very objectionable to some subscribers. And if that's the only broadband hike coming to your home and you need broadband, you don't like the terms of service or the privacy policy, it's tough. You know, if there are, on the other hand, competitive providers, then it's, you can choose. And this is, it's, you know, I have often said, we'll say, you know, that having the ways to get to the internet, if some regulation is there to assure you really do have choices, is really the key to avoiding a lot of other regulation of the internet itself. And this is a perfect example. I mean, if there were, say, privacy policies that were just plain objectionable, and if there's the only way to get broadband, the government probably would have to step in and do something about it. But today, it hasn't been an issue at all because when ISP has objectionable terms of service or privacy policies, people just choose somebody else.
Did you want to get a dig in on that, or?
No, because I think on the privacy, it's kind of simple, I think, in a way, and very hard to implement. I think we're trying to make sure that customers are able to manage their lives, respecting the rules of this land the way they want to. And if we want parents to be able to manage and make sure the information their children see is what they prefer them to see. We want adults to be able to go where they want to go on the internet. So,
except for what other adults in power may not want them to see.
And you want the ability to have a consumer in this country decide for themselves what information about themselves they want somebody else to know about. There are customers that we know of, ACG customers, that are quite comfortable with letting out a lot of information about themselves. The reason is that it makes it easy for others to help them organize their life. So Yahoo, when you register for Yahoo or Amazon.com, they're looking for your stylistic lifestyle preferences for how you think about the things you important to your life, either materially or whatever, such that they can organize the web in a way that delivers only those things to you and not a bunch of other stuff. Some people really like that. On the other hand, some people are pretty private. And they don't want to get that information out. So that's their call too. So let's not work against the consumer choice. That's really what's key here. Now, part of what Charles was referring to in the at-home case is that, you know, we built a broadband internet access company to provide consumers a chance to go to the internet. What we found out is when we put the terms for service up, what customers, some artful people were doing, were building businesses in their home that had tremendous websites in their home, and what they were using it for was creating a large hosting service or a large destination portal. That's not what the design for the service was, and as a result, it blew up the network. We just couldn't serve the other customers because these other folks had abused what we thought was an internet access offer. So that doesn't mean if somebody wants to offer a large website in their home to create a portal, create a Yahoo in their house, we can build a service for them to do that.
But that charge them appropriately.
Charge them appropriately for it. Let's not mess up what everybody else is trying to do just because somebody else is abusing the service. So there were some design and engineering problems that we ran into that we're going to solve. But that's different than saying we're denying customers their choice.
But is your desire to charge them appropriately, part of it is the engineering problem of suddenly everybody else is calling up and complaining and their service is slow.
Yeah.
But if that problem were solved, you do a backbone upgrade, so you can have actually people operating businesses out of their homes, streaming, you know, what they do in their house all day, and then people subscribe to watch what they do in their house all day, that kind of thing. You would be happy.
It's a vicious market.
So engineering aside, and engineering standards, like basically you should only use this much bandwidth aside, would you have a desire to price your service on the basis of its use in some way? If you want to use this much bandwidth because it's for personal use, it'll cost this much, versus if you want to use the same amount of bandwidth but it's for business use, we want to charge you more because if it's for business use, you've got a deeper pocket. I mean, classic price discrimination.
I think you had touched on it earlier. I believe, Marianne, you said there might be some business school students in here as well. This gets to the microeconomics of this thing, and that is that in any business, any static point or any dynamic point in time, there are fixed costs and fees and variable costs, right? And as you get scale economies, as technology comes through and reorganize how costs are dealt with, you have the chance as a business to decide whether you want to flat rate something or variable price something. And it may be a function of how you organize the economics for a particular set of customers who want to use it a certain way, or maybe how you want to organize economics and price according to a different set of users, how they use it. So there could be a flat rate for internet access, which is what we offer today at home, it's $40 a month. However, if you want to offer a website which has got a lot of variability, it ends up having a lot of dynamics in terms of downloads and uploads. Its characteristics of use are much different than that of somebody, a consumer internet access. You're going to organize your pricing differently. I don't know what the answer is per se, but you want to be able to be competitive. You want to be able to offer that particular customer the best competitive choice to do what they're going to do. It happens to use your assets differently than the other guy down the street. So I think the answer on flat rate usage, pricing, or whatever is going to vary by what customers are going to be doing what they want to do. As long as you're offering the best value, customers will pay variable pricing. You've seen that.
Why don't we open it up a little bit for questions, but how should we orchestrate this? I'll just try and this way. And maybe if you care too much, introduce yourself, just who you are, and then ask your question.
Sure. I'm Charlie Pluckham from Stevens Incorporated. I don't know if this is working.
A little switch on the bottom.
I suppose you can just spell them at any time.
Technology. Charles Pluckham from Stevens Incorporated. A narrow board question for Jim and Ed, mainly, I think. Right now, when a CLEC wants to offer broadband service on Ed's network, you know, they would co-locate, you know, central office, and they would put in a digital subscriber line access, all these things they would do it.
I knew this was going to happen. The first question, I'm already completely lost.
But they put in a box to do it. And what I'm hearing is that in the near future, the switch makers will be upgrading their class 5 switches to run DSL right off that switch. So there will be no separation between the baseline and switch. And Jim, maybe you could help me out here. My understanding is that a CLEC is not necessarily authorized to put a class 5 switch, you know, in the cage. If they can put a baseline in there, but now something higher. Now, if running DSL off the switch gives the RBOC a big cost advantage over a CLEC, what are the regulatory implications here? I mean, because there are wiring issues with wiring up the baseline, maybe this company just got by virtue of having ADSL running off or HDSL running off the switch, a $200 or $300 per line cost advantage that the CLEC cannot get because they're not allowed to put class 5 switch in co-located. How do you handle that?
Well, the commission has not definitively answered all of the questions you just asked. Let me step back a step and say the Supreme Court earlier this year largely affirmed the local competition rules that the commission prescribed 6 months after enactment of the 96 Act. The commission was reversed and remanded on one piece of this huge order to implement the market opening provisions of the Act. And that was the piece that dealt with the manner in which we identified the unbundled network elements that the incumbent local exchange carriers have to make available to other requesting carriers, or CLECs, as you call them. And so the commission is conducting a proceeding to identify those, to go back and make sure that the network elements, the unbundled network elements that are required to be made available have been processed through the correct legal standard in Section 251D2.
Oh, yeah.
They beat us on that one. And the commission has to do that. So that will, but I did hear him acknowledge before, I think he said loops, switching, transport were all unbundled. Well, they have to do those, so that's a good start. The commission is just going to do that and do it, you know, go back and the court said to do that one again, and the commission is doing that one again. The commission has also dealt with a number of the problems that have been brought to its attention in the first 3 years after enactment, problems relating to co-location. And it released an order and a further notice of proposed rulemaking just 2 weeks ago. And you mentioned a cage. Well, cageless co-location has to be made available now, too. The commission deleted the requirement that that competitive local exchange carriers co-locate in Bell-O-Matic and other incumbent carrier central offices only equipment that lacks a switching functionality. Actually, there wasn't any such requirement, but it had been misunderstood and there was some confusion, and the commission eliminated the confusion. So the fact that some CLEC equipment has a switching component is not going to be an impediment to the co-location of that equipment. So a number of the co-location issues have been addressed very recently by the commission in a way that should address a number of these problems, but the issue of precisely which unbundled network elements will be provided, that's back up for grabs to some extent. And also the state commissions are going to need some time to bring themselves into compliance with certain elements of the commission's local competition rules, which the commission did not try to set prices for resale or for unbundled network elements. It did establish pricing principles. Some states and some incumbents resisted the commission's authority to establish those principles, and the Supreme Court's now upheld that authority. So now the industry's going to need a little time, and the state commissions are going to need a little time to bring themselves into compliance. So we're still a little bit in a shakeout period on this, but meanwhile, as you can see in the broadband report the commission put out in February, there are lots of instances where broadband competitive local exchange providers are working with incumbent local exchange carriers and getting the equipment into central offices and getting the services out to the consumers and I won't say everybody's happy, but a tremendous amount of progress has been made, notwithstanding that not every question has been answered and certainly not every dispute has been avoided.
I said I felt sorry for the FCC. I now feel really sorry for the D.C. Circuit that has to hear these cases on appeal and somehow, in the absence of the staff, figure out exactly how to map all of it.
Although you'd be surprised, the judges are very able, very interested, and when our local competition rules went to the Supreme Court, we saw a very active and engaged and knowledgeable bench.
I'm Butch Melzer from Secure Visita. As a broadband internet customer, I'm not a typical customer, but all I want is, you know, the IP number all the time. And I have a question for Mr. Burr. Would it be an acceptable arrangement for, instead of gaining access to the broadband plan, would it be acceptable to have the broadband providers decouple any other service besides giving the IP number, you know, for instance, mail, news hosting, any other of the extras that comes with broadband? Or, you know, specifically, are you seeking access to the plan?
No, it would not be acceptable. I think the essence of what we provide is really helping people connect to the internet and helping them effectively use it. It's connectivity and service and support. And without the connectivity, we cannot deliver the rest of our services. We cannot effectively support the customer if we're not involved in delivering the connectivity. I mean, we can't do our job.
That question pierces the issue very well. Charles and I would maybe debate. If it were, as we've done it at home, our broadband service, as you all know, I'll describe it. The first screen comes up and it says at home on it. But it's what we call a persistent connection. In other words, it's online all the time. You never do shut the service down. You may shut your computer down, but the service is always up. It doesn't operate like a LAN, but it appears to, like a local area network. Now, in the at-home service, the customer has the choice. They have the at-home screen that they choose to reconfigure that screen such that it's always on AOL. They can do that. And so it's always on AOL, or it's always on Yahoo, or it's always on Excite, or Disney. The customer has the choice to do that. The first time the screen comes up, they need to click through, but once they reconfigure their browser, it works. Now, people would debate that. Charles may not. I know Steve Case would say, well, but that's for a different reason, because his motives are different, his business strategy is different. The reason I raise that point is that when Charles first described his business, he broke it into three parts. The user interface, and he described AOL as having an easy one for customers. Although once you're in the AOL space, they do some things that don't allow customer choice. The network. We talked about the enhanced provider exception and how he's able to get a favorable rate, a deadly claim to get into the house and provide the service. He also described support. And he emphasized support as being a unique dimension of his business. So I think the issue here is that we would want to have Charles use the at-home network to present his brand to the customer. But what he distinguished himself on is admittedly not getting to the customer via the servers, but offering new kinds of support, content, emails, whatever the heck he wants to, but he'd look like a website more so than an internet access provider in doing that. There are a number of businesses that are doing that with us now. We have what's called an at-media subsidiary that allows people to use the at-home network to get into the home and allow customers to reconfigure it and go to wherever they want to go. And so we don't think that that's denying access to the cable plan. All it says is that the platform we've got to use is that it should be a computing platform, which we've invested in to allow customers to do that, that allows us to organize the network so that everybody gets the right level of service on this broadband plan. And if you've got a proposition that allows the customer to enjoy support and added value beyond what your current business model is, come on in. There's a commercial negotiation we can have. We've offered that to AOL, to Yahoo, to Site, anyway. So the plan's not closed. In our view, you're trying to allow as much access to the internet, and allow these businesses to couple up with ours to do that. At the same time, the argument for being closed is not closed to the internet, it's rather we need to make sure that the physical access to it is managed by us because you've got to get the economics to work to compete with Ed. So she said, see if the market's working at the same time, say, don't destroy the economics of human ed, but let's maximize the ability for everybody to use it to get to the internet. We're trying to pierce that price-value relationship right in there. And it's a raging debate, and it's very complex, and you get into these arcane subjects of, URLs and how you organize the first screen and, key cases model for doing it, proprietary versus non-proprietary software and all kinds of stuff. And I think the level of education in forms like this is helping.
Yeah, I could just follow up there a little bit, John.
Sure.
The Essence Smart Service has almost nothing to do with the first web page that you see, and that is not MindSpring service. When you talk about choosing your service provider, delivering what will be the core telecom service we all use, and the important things are, one is the last mile connectivity, which will be common among various competing service providers in my view of the world, and then everything else will be different. The wide area connectivity will be different, various services that you offer to those customers, other connection will be different, and extremely importantly, the service and support that you help them have a good experience with this connection will be different. And we can't deliver that unless we're involved in delivering the connectivity. And the argument that so the incentive to invest is destroyed by running an open network the way every other telecom network is open, I think there's just no evidence to back that up at all. I mean, I understand that AT&T and the other cable companies might want a monopoly, but that there's no incentive to invest is a thing. Easy to defeat sort of assertion that you can't back it up.
Just a quick question on your portal point. When you look at the top 10 hit sites on the web, among them primarily are the default sites, not sites that you get a sense people are visiting because they love them or found them, but sites that were the first sites put in front of eyeballs before they then go off to wherever they're going. So you're actually, at least for these purposes, minimizing the value of that, of MindSpring as a first site and a set of eyeballs that you can then direct elsewhere or build a portal out of.
There's two different businesses. Not that that's a bad one, but there's an underlying service business that's separate from that content.
And you're happy to be in both.
Yeah, and by far the main one for us is the service one. I mean, it's we have less than 1% of our revenue derives from all that content portal kind of stuff.
That's this is important for just getting into the internet part of it. This industry is disaggregated, and so you have websites that are portals, and then you have websites that are destinations, and then you have the access part of it, as Charles is describing. I don't know the numbers, you'll know it better than I do, but I think there are about 4,500 internet access providers in the country. 4,500 of these kinds of businesses. I think it's, depending on the account, it could be as many as several hundreds, not thousands, of long distance providers in the country. And it's able to get upset with me. There aren't many local telephone company providers.
Fewer and fewer, though.
Fewer and fewer, because they're all swallowing each other. They swallow
through their 14.
Well, they're fewer. the essence of this is that the value that's being provided to customers is being layered in the telecom and services industry much the way the computer industry went through in the 70s. So when IBM, you had these vertical structures, IBM, DEC, et cetera. And what happened was IBM, frankly, in introducing Intel and Microsoft to produce chips and software, they began to specialize in these activities and became very good at that particular layer of work. Horizontal layer work and disaggregated the industry such that now you've got chip providers, you've got software providers, you've got disk providers, and the whole industry became a disaggregated thing and then reorganized itself such that companies began to lash up commercial relationships between each other to deliver value to the end user. One would argue that what happened is you had this proprietary model that had moderate volumes, very high profits. It got broken up such that now it's an open model in the computer industry, got supernormal volumes, right? The margins have been. The overall profitability went up, and the wealth creation, the employment creation that came out of that was tremendous in the computer industry. The telecom sector is going through the same thing now, and the web is doing it. And all of a sudden you've got the access part of it, and I'm arguing here that you want a multiplicity of access. You've got the first intelligence after the house, call it the class 5 switch by reference, or first intelligence switch node, and it's going to be people who, you've got a whole bunch of long distance providers now who kind of have all these backbones. And it's a further parsing up of all that as people begin to organize eyeballs, as Ed put it, such that you have Disney wanting to put its website out there because their children today watch cartoons Saturday morning, and after they've been watching the cartoons, they go to the web, and the same characters are there, and they play games with the same characters. So you see this very different structure organizing. You don't want to prevent that in any way, but what I described was a way set of markets, new markets being invented every day. And the only issue that we are debating is that the physical connection market is a different market than the other ones I described. You've got to be careful about how the economics get formed to focus on the physical connection market. You want to proliferate competition there. We're not afraid of the fact that wireless is going to compete with our cable plan. In fact, we're going to foment it because we can't own all the cable companies in the country. We've got TPI. As a result, we don't have cable plan in many of those areas. To do that, we've got to either put fixed wireless in or some high-speed wireless connection or something. So we're going to want to accelerate wireless into the market as a substitute. We're going to want to use XDSL into the market. So the physical issues are different than the logical issues, and the whole markets that are evolving in the internet are logical issues as opposed to physical.
Can we pass the mic over here?
Yeah, I think it's very interesting that the issue that seems to predominate is where is AT&T providing equal access. And maybe things haven't changed that much as far as the debates are concerned. Let me identify myself first. My name is Jeff Binder. I'm a telecommunications consultant slash attorney. And in the interest of full disclosure, I was at Young's General Counsel for Bell Atlantic New England through the end of last year. I'll let you all judge by the end of the day whether you think I no longer work for Ed or virtually work for him, if not actually, by my comments. But I also would like to pursue this very topic of opening up the cable network and sort of make an assessment in my own mind as to the sense or nonsense of the FCC policy, which, as Jim made clear, is that as of today, the FCC says, there's no need for us to tell AT&T to open up the cable network. And I think the FCC's made it clear that they're saying, as of today, we'll see what evolves. And my question goes to Charles, essentially, and it is, how close are you, really, to being able to use AT&T's network, or should I say, how close is AT&T with its PCI in the cable world to providing you with the physical network that you want equal access to, that this equal access issue, is it really a burning issue today as opposed to 1 year, 2 year, or 3 years? And if that's the case, are you not better off if AT&T's whole, oh, go off on your own, do all your investments, as they say they're going to do, if they want to believe that someday, again, they'll be able to shoot fish in a barrel by not providing equal access on an essential facility, let them go ahead and believe that. But would not the last mile perhaps be duplicated more quickly if AT&T can go on at its own, make those investments, and then when the time is right, if it's really essential, the FCC will step in at that point. So it's a question of timing that I'm, you know, really asking you about on that policy.
Yeah. See, I can't imagine the investments not happening either way. I mean, this is whether you have to carry traffic just for your own brand or for other brands as well. I think the cable companies can make more money opening up their networks. We do this by way of one cable company's network, a big one, and they're a competitive overbill company in Southeast. And they, and by the way, not only are they competitive, they're also backed by telecom guys, which is different than most cable industry companies, and therefore I think they have a different outlook. But from the beginning, they've been convinced that they can generate more traffic, more revenue, better return on their investment by opening up a network. And technically, we've found that it's not difficult. It's not. And so the way it works is we plug into a router that the cable company had in, and And basically, they carry our bits through the local hybrid fiber coax network, not unlike other ones, back and forth to the customer's house. We pay them primarily a per customer fee, although it could be per bit, or there's also a sort of port fee to connect to the network to begin with. They're happy about it, and they're certainly continue to build out in the markets they have targeted in the Southeast. So I don't think that an open access requirement now slows that down. And I do think that not having it now runs a real risk of sort of getting the wrong structure ingrained in the industry. I mean, the openness and the competition that goes with it and innovation that are part of the net, we are at risk here, I believe. And letting that get entrenched in any way is difficult. I mean, just sort of imagine the wailing that would take place in years in the future if this requirement were introduced later. I guess my final point is I think it's what the law says now. You know, I think it's pretty clear this is a telecommunication service, and therefore you're supposed to provide some non-discriminatory access and retail provisions. This is what all telecom companies do.
Yeah, if I just follow up, obviously it's a very subjective assessment we all make on this, but with respect to the investment that AT&T is going to make, it sounds like what you're saying is they're going to do it anyway.
Yeah.
And I would respectfully disagree, at least a degree, on that, because I think the key to opening up the local exchange, which I think was the key of the Telecommunications Act, rather than long distance, that was sort of a tail for the Arbox. But the key is to open up the last mile. And if AT&T does that, the sooner they do that, if they can do it with their strategy, the sooner they do that, the more pressure falls on the Arbox. And is it not really competition that's going to promote the most investment here? And I would just look to the fact that all of a sudden the Arbox are tripping over themselves to try and get DSL service out there because they were horrified when they saw the cable companies coming out with the cable modems. Good idea to be scared about that. So I guess I'm just saying, I'm wondering if we're better off with the FCC policy. Let them spend the money for a while, and if it gets to the point where it's necessary, we'll do it. But it is, as I say, going back to my original point, it's interesting. AT&T equal access is the big issue of this conversation, and maybe is that.
But you fell asleep for 20 years, woke up or something.
Come on, that's really good.
It sounds like you work for John. Yeah. Question here, I thought?
No?
Oh, okay. Chris Bonner with CTI Magazine. It sounds to me, from the outside, that both the Arbox and the cable companies are faced with a similar situation, that they're trying to provide broadband access over a network that wasn't meant to support broadband access. And it seems that they would be faced with equal costs in providing broadband access now. You have to put in these lanes, you have to put in routers, AT&T has to put in routers and things like that. Why is it that AT&T sees it as being something that they have to hold on to and build, whereas the Arbox sees it as something that, by law, they're required to share as they build the network and to provide that capacity? And I guess to continue on perhaps any other gentleman's question, once the network for AT&T TCI is in place for cable service, do you see that being opened up? Because your argument so far for not opening it has been you need to build that network. Once the network's in place, 5 years down the road, will that be opened up or no?
There are two questions. Let me start with the latter one and work to the first one. The technology is moving along a pace where, frankly, the way the cable plant works is that as you enable more and more services to be put on it, you actually are able to economically justify pulling fiber deeper into the territories. So this is a way of actually getting broadband into the home by pulling fiber behind coax as you build volume. So you've got to understand that theory first. The investments that are being made, as I mentioned earlier, first, these plants have to be upgraded in such that they can carry more volume. Secondly, and contemporaneously, they got to be able to go two-way. Thirdly, they got to be made digital. And what that allows them to do is bring more channels, digital channels, for every 6 megahertz spectrum. We now can derive like 12 to 15 digital TV channels. And so if you deal with that, pulling fiber closer to the plant, not only are you offering internet access, but you're offering more channels. And because of the IP nature, that distributed computing platform I described earlier, you now have got the opportunity for interactive TV. And think of a world where Malone said it at the time he was first talking to Bell Atlantic, the first attempted merger. Think of a world where you have 800 to 1,000 channels. And that really, consumers have the choice now picking from a great variety of content and a great variety of services that, frankly, the content and programming industry, would be it music or be it video or be it individual artists, so we don't want to pay a label anymore. You know, the whole web now can come through the TV platform, the PC platform, and as more and more of these phones end up having screens on them, you end up having the ability to do that too. So, in a long-winded way of saying to you, there's a massive investment program going on to do that, bring it home. The opening up of the physical plant doesn't allow the cable companies to organize the value to do that. And as a result, we can't justify the economics to do that. In other words, you're taking a physical resource that needs to have all that physical, all that work done to it, billions of dollars to upgrade for that opportunity. I think your real question was, as our friend said a moment ago, there's going to be a point in time that if sufficient competition isn't brought to market against that, would it be opened up? And I think that's a decision society is going to make. But don't do it now. Until you can't get it done, you'll stop.
What about the comparison between what the networks, the outbox are facing in charge costs? I know there's a two-way network already in place versus a one-way network.
Well, there's nothing to prevent them from pulling fiber closer to the home.
David Gerge is a graduate student at MIT.
Just a graduate student at MIT. Right.
It brings down the whole network.
Well, the question is directed, I guess, at Mr. Gerge and Mr. Young. Lightspring wants to offer DSL services to residential consumers in, let's say, Massachusetts. So it probably works the same way as you wanted to do it for ISDN. You tell the consumer we have the service, then you turn around and talk to Mr. Young about Bell Atlantic, and they provide the back end. So it's the actual physical service, but to the end consumer, it's all Mindspring. But then Mr. Young mentioned earlier today that if he would have his way, that he would have the restrictions for unbundling lifted from him because he wants to play on the same field as Mr. Petrillo. So what happens if you get your way, Mr. Young? Do you still want to provide service to Mindspring? Is this a good business decision, or are you only doing it because you feel you have to?
Well, as I mentioned before, our own internet service provider efforts have been less than stellar. We believe that the best way to maximize our revenue is to make our DSL service available at the lowest possible price or the economically efficient price to as many ISPs as possible. So that's our strategy at the moment.
What if you get successful?
I think it would still be our strategy, but then we might be able to get more, sort of operate in a business environment where you could provide additional teaming opportunities. In addition to being prohibited from having a closed network, there are restrictions placed upon how we can market information services. That's one of the things, by the way, that the Act was supposed to phase out this year, joint marketing of information services. So there are some additional requirements that need to be relaxed in order for us to act more like a normal business and operating in the real world where we pick partners and devise ventures and design products that are mutually beneficial.
Mr. Brewer, do you fear in the future that Bell Atlantic will phase it out?
Well, it is certainly critically important that the last mile connectivity through the telephone company continue to be open the way kind of marketing the cable company should be open as well.
By the way, what was the term of their contract?
What's that?
What's the term of your deal with each other?
Well, we don't have any DSL rights in place with the Bell Atlantic currently, although I hope that we will. There are three ways we can roll out DSL. One is we could go ahead and put in this DSLAM stuff ourselves, which may actually make sense in some places if we really have a lot of subscriber density. Or we can essentially buy the data transport service from Bell Atlantic or the other local phone company. Or we could buy a similar service from companies like NorthPoint and Covad, the, what do we call them, DSL CLEX, maybe? That's what we call them. And for the residential market, to start now, or today anyway, it seems like working directly with regional bell operating companies or the incumbent local phone company is generally the way we'll get this rolling.
That's a very interesting point. To what extent would you be willing to capitalize the equipment yourself to get as close to the home as possible, and maybe rent only the loops from them?
Well, it's pretty much just an economic decision. We're certainly willing to do it. We can do it and economically, perhaps, in some places where we have a lot of subscriber density. But to have to do it everywhere would certainly be, create a higher barrier to entry in each given local market.
Could it be financed, though?
Oh, yeah, I think it can be financed. I mean, look at rhythms.
That's the point I'm pushing on, because I mentioned earlier there are 4,500 companies like this.
Of course, but we still depend on the lines. Financing
only
really is another
there are
line.
Also 1,400 long-distance companies like AT&T.
It's a
huge difference between facilities-based and non-facilities.
Exactly right. We're talking about the local market, not the long-distance market. And as a result, right now, there's scarcity there. And the financial markets are recognizing. So Covad or Rhythms or even Teleport, which we bought, these companies can be financed to build alternate physical paths. And it doesn't mean you have to swoop in with the actual line itself to get started. You can build equipment, which these other companies are doing, to get there. So the idea here is, how does this industry organize the businesses that they have? Then you have to consolidate with others to do it. And how do you end up with
that?
I didn't mean there's a lot of companies out there. There's a lot of companies. Stock value right now, your company is worth about $3 billion. You have about a million customers. The stock value of your company looks like AOL. So you think about the ability for him to go buy up some of his smaller competitors, organize a business, finance it, and put the very equipment he's talking about, he may not be willing to capitalize now, and start to build his way. When he organizes these customers, organizes these other businesses, Wall Street will finance them, he starts building his way forward. All I'm suggesting is, you've got to be careful. Let's organize investor money to do this job, rather than force on taxpayers.
I'd like the record to reflect, actually, Mr. Meisner, that AT&T says that there are alternatives to the local